From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made in your twilight years. Well, not really. It was made on your phone screen, which showed you a picture of what you might look like in your twilight years. The picture comes from a mobile app called FaceApp, which uses artificial intelligence to transform pictures submitted by users. The app first went viral in 2017, but the most recent filter, which shows users an older version of themselves, went super nuclear viral. Maybe you saw celebrities posting their FaceApp photos. Maybe your friends and family were trying it out. Maybe you did too. More than 100 million people downloaded the app, but some users weren't too happy. And I'm not just talking about what the app predicted their future selves might look like. They expressed criticism about privacy when they learned FaceApp's developer is based in Russia. In less than 24 hours, the news went as viral as the app did, with warnings that FaceApp was harvesting personal data. Senator Chuck Schumer expressed his concerns over to the FBI and the FTC about threats to national security and privacy. The Democratic National Committee sent an email to all 2020 presidential campaigns warning them not to use the app. So what is FaceApp's developer actually doing with your data? Experts say concerns about interference by the Russian government are overblown, but they also say they're glad people are thinking about privacy. Apps like Facebook, Snapchat, and others collect user data every day. How many of us actually understand how they use it? So here are some questions for you. When you use apps or websites, how often do you click yes when asked to share your photos or data? Do you read the privacy policies? If someone approached you on the street and asked you to share your IP address, would you give it to them? Granted, many of us wouldn't know what it is, but even if we did, my guess is that most of us would say no. So why do we do it without even thinking when we're online? This hour, our guests help us understand how our personal information is collected, used, and shared when we use certain apps and websites. We'll also talk about what our rights are when it comes to privacy and what our expectations are or should be in the age of social media. I'd like to welcome my guests for the hour. And the credit about the IP on the street question, the credit goes to Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law. Welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for that question that really got my brain percolating. I have no idea what my IP address is.
Well, I'm out then.
Also joining us is Jonathan Weissman, senior lecturer in the Department of Computing Security at RIT. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And welcome back to Emily Hesney Lynch, social media strategist and founder of Serve Me the Sky Digital. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Megan. Glad to be here.
So my first question for all of you, I'm just going to go around the table, is ask you, did you use FaceApp? Scott Maloof.
No, I'm pretty resistant to those challenges.
Because?
You know, I think when you spend all the time writing and thinking about it, the next one and the next one, they just kind of get tiring for you after a while. Plus, you know, looking older, I just look in the mirror every day. It's all good.
Emily Hesney Lynch, did you use FaceApp?
I did not use FaceApp. I didn't quite see the appeal of it. I figure I'll see myself at whatever age as I get to that age, and that's good enough for me.
You've been very open about that on Twitter, talking about why you didn't want to try it. Jonathan Weissman.
I have not, and for the same reason, if I want to know what I'm going to look like in the future, I'll open up an old photo album of my parents.
Okay, so nobody in this room has tried it out. Listeners, if you have, I want to hear about your experiences, not only in what you saw, but also if you had any concerns about privacy. Were you worried about your information being shared? Did you understand what the terms of service are? You can call the program at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org. And you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. So we'll dive into how FaceApp collects, stores, uses your information. But I think it's first important to acknowledge that lots of other social media apps do this every single day. That's right, Scott? I mean, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, they're all collecting our data every single day.
Right. I mean, it's the advertising economy. The whole point, you know, is, as Mark Zuckerberg said, we sell ads, Senator, right? And they do it because they're, and Emily can speak to this, I'm sure, much better, they're slicing and dicing folks. I want to talk to people on the western side of Monroe County. I want to talk to people who go to Canandaigua on the weekends. The only way you're able to do that is because the apps are collecting that data. And that's the business model, getting much more detailed information on people so you can sell ads to them.
Mm-hmm. Emily, I have to admit, I have no idea how any of this works. I'm not a big social media user, and I don't often think about how my information is out there. Do you think most people have a general understanding? Is there like a 101 type understanding of how our information is used?
I think there's probably a pretty vague and nebulous understanding of how our information is used. And a lot of the time people are jumping to conclusions like Facebook is listening to us with a microphone and recording our conversations to target ads to us, which I personally don't believe is happening, but I know many people who think that's true. But I think there is a kind of lack of basic understanding because you don't learn about these things in school and technology evolves so quickly. You don't really know how to keep up with all the changes sometimes.
It's Alexa that's listening to us.
Yeah.
Yes, true.
With that in mind, Jonathan, what do you want people to know? What do you want them to understand at a very basic level about what they're submitting when they use a website or an app?
Well, in general, it's the same advice I give for apps that I give for IoT, Internet of Things devices. For instance, a Crock-Pot at home that has an IP address that can be monitored from some remote location, that sort of defeats the whole purpose of a Crock-Pot for me. So you have to risk, you have to weigh the risks versus the inherent benefits. So with the app in question right now, with FaceApp in question, you have to say to yourself, is it really worth it to risk my photos, my personally identifiable information, being in potential hands I don't want it to be in, for what? And generally, the pendulum will swing to the side of, it's just not worth it. And users have to really evaluate in the same fashion. Does it really make sense to put yourself in such a vulnerable position in certain cases?
But the challenge, I think, comes in is convenience is the real trade-off. Mm. Oh, I want to shop at Target, so I want to use their app and get 5% off as opposed to, you know, looking for paper coupons, assuming they even exist anymore. You know, or using these tools, using Facebook, say, to sign into that next site. I mean, that's the real challenge is it's easy to say, oh, you know, I'm going to check the box and no, I'm not going to do these things until they become things we have to do to have that.
But there are lots of times when an app might be requesting a little bit too much.
Absolutely.
For instance, the proverbial example is a flashlight app. Why would a flashlight app need access to your camera, your photos, your location data? Users don't know, like you were saying, Emily, with this nebulous instructions that were provided, what exactly is being sent from the phone to some company.
Mm-hmm. Well, that ties into the whole terms of service issue with FaceApp, which I think makes it a little different than some other terms of service. And I can read those in a moment. But how many of you around the table read the terms of service? I don't. I'm calling myself out. I don't read them.
No, almost never.
No. Jonathan? You do, don't you?
Well, look, I'm a very technical guy.
You sit down to dinner and a glass of wine and read the terms of service.
But the point is that these terms of service are purposely meant to be as general and nebulous as possible so that the company can twist them any way they like.
And we'll turn to the attorney in the room to hear what FaceApp can do based on their terms of service. So let me read those for you, listeners. These are the terms of service just in part. You grant FaceApp a perpetual, non-exclusive, royalty-free, worldwide, fully paid, transferable, sub-licensable license to use, reproduce, modify, adapt, publish, translate, create derivative works from, distribute, publicly perform, and display your user content and any name, username, or likeness provided in connection with your user content in all media formats and channels now known or later developed without compensation to you. When you post or otherwise share user content on or through our services, you understand that your user content and any associated information, such as your username, location, or profile photo, will be visible to the public. That's just one paragraph.
I feel like we should applaud you after that.
Oh, thanks. I did it in two breaths, so I feel pretty good about it. But really, Scott, what does that mean? That means that they can use your content for any purpose they see without paying you at any point, anywhere in the world.
So
did I sum that up fairly?
You summed it up fairly. I mean, that's the real challenge of the app economy, of the sharing economy, in the sense of you're creating data. And when that data is created, there are certain rights that adhere to it. The simplest one is just copyright. You know, Emily took a photo just before we started. She owns the copyright in that photo, okay? And when she posted it, others are going to want to share it. So all of a sudden, if I'm Twitter, I need to say, how do I create a situation where she gives me a license that I can then pass on to those other users and they can reshare it and reshare it so that 5 years later, you know, Emily doesn't come back and say, wait a minute, you all violated my copyright. So that's why you have those kinds of terms of service. Now, you know, you and I in talking about this, you said, hey, is this really that different than the other sites? And the answer is yes and no. It's, you know, Facebook gives itself that kind of license. YouTube gives itself that kind of license. This is an older style of language, you know, that I think gave people a little bit of pause. But the other sites give themselves that kind of permission. What they're not clear on, what FaceApp is not clear on, is when that right terminates. A lot of these sites based in the U.S. have gotten better about saying when these rights terminate and how we control it. But the big issue is Russia. It's that the data goes to Russia. And, you know, it's not a strong judicial system there. You don't know how that data is being protected. So that's why I think the concern is, in a lot of ways, on a 50,000-foot level, justified.
So the developer of FaceApp says that your photos are actually going to their servers, which are owned by Amazon and Google. They're not going anywhere in Russia. Is it fair, the concerns that we've heard about, you know, what's keeping the Russian government from demanding this data from this developer? Could he give it away willingly or unwillingly?
I think that's a fair concern because, I mean, if you look at, you know, in the United States, you know, social media data in individual criminal investigations is requested all the time. So, yeah, that's a valid concern. And you know, timely for us is the California Supreme Court just let stand an order from a trial judge where defendants had requested in a murder trial to get social media messages that were private on behalf of the defendants. Very much unforeseen. You know, it's outside of the norm. So people should say, you know what, when data becomes useful, the party to whom it's useful is not going to worry about your privacy and why you posted it. They're going to say, I really need it, mm-hmm. be it a government or an individual.
And while the data is being stored in the United States, the FaceApp privacy policy does state that the information and all data being retained on those servers can definitely be transferred to all countries involved in the development, including, of course, Russia. And with all the data breaches and hacks, whether they were intentional or actual leaks going on, we can't really take that chance today. And I like to think of it as the devil you know versus the devil you do not know. In terms of Facebook, we know what we're dealing with. In terms of Instagram, we know what we're dealing with. In terms of FaceApp, we're not really quite sure what we're dealing with at this point.
I think to me that the way you, as an individual user, do this isn't so much through the terms of service. It's really taking a step and saying, okay, when you're going to download an app or you're looking at the app in the store, the iTunes store, the Play store, Google Play store, you look at the permissions. You know, go back to, it's the flashlight. Why does it need access to my microphone? That's your first thing. And then secondly, how many downloads are there? You know, something that has a billion downloads has probably been through the ringer versus something that has 10,000. And then what's the biggest point is, what's the business model of the organization? And I think that's a really good example. You know, Facebook, based in the United States, it has a billion-dollar business. Google, same thing. Versus, you know, Joe's Backyard App Shop, and we don't even know where that is. So you don't follow Joe's Backyard App Shop?
I just thought that'd be a funny improv group name or something like that.
Back half, right?
Yeah. I think it's interesting when you try to think about your own personal best practices for how you're approaching all these apps. Like, one thing I've been thinking about is Spotify. I've been a Spotify user for years and years, and they have an amazing advertising campaign where they put data up on billboards and they say, oh, to the person who's streamed Sorry by Justin Bieber 110 times in a row, like, we hope you feel better soon and stuff like that. If someone used my data like that, I'd probably laugh about it. It's a funny marketing campaign. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But when you think about the nefarious purposes other companies are using your data for, how are you as a user supposed to know what the end game is? It's tough to evaluate.
Absolutely. And now that you bring up billboards, some of the concern that experts have about FaceApp is that, you know, if I submit my photo to this app for fun purposes, I could show up on a billboard somewhere around the world promoting some product. I have no idea what it is. Is that something you think we need to be genuinely concerned about?
I think that goes back to the business model. You know, and the example I would give is, okay, Joe's Backyard App Shop. Joe's may, after 6 months, they're not making any money. And so they say, let's take all these things that we in theory have rights to and let's put them on mugs. And so, hey, here's the, you know, the picture of Cardi B. And Cardi B now is 20 years older. Let's sell that. Versus, you know, if it were a bank and a bank did the exact same thing, the bank would say, wait a minute, you know, we're about trust. We're about people believing that we use their data appropriately. And someone in the bank presumably would say, we're not going to do that. So I think it really goes to the business model. That's how you assess these things. And that's where the pressure points come back. The other big point is we've seen Senator Schumer and others have said, FTC, FBI, take a look at this. Mm-hmm. And I think that may come back, as well as Google and Apple saying, you know, is this the kind of behavior we want our app developers to be engaged in?
So if we had a listener call in right now and say, you know, are the concerns overblown? Should I delete this now? Send in my request, because that's something you can do. Send in a request to have everything removed from the site. I'm not sure how long it takes. Would you say yes to that? Yes, you know, the concerns, I'm sorry, know the concerns. Are the concerns overblown? Let me ask a simple question, Scott. Are the concerns overblown about Russia?
It's up to the individual user. Okay. And again, it's not just Russia. You know, maybe you've decided that this is a company who, once they gather that data, you don't really know how they're going to use it, even if they were based in Estonia or France, et cetera. So maybe you say, all right, I've made the request. Please delete it. If you don't make the request and they use it, then you didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, are the concerns overblown?
I like Scott said, I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. What strikes me as a little suspicious is that, obviously, we don't know too much about the company. And obviously, they're from Russia. But when you think about it, what's the nature of the company? The nature of the company is to make you appear as you don't appear. It's to alter reality. So when you think about it, with deepfakes in mm-hmm. the news all the time now, I mean, Mona Lisa was speaking just a couple of weeks ago. She came to life. When you think about the rise of deepfakes and the rise of fake news, and with the presidential election coming up as well, you could have somebody's picture from FaceApp morphed into the future, maybe proportionally to the election or maybe two elections down the road, and with the advent of deepfakes, having them speak and say something that they never said. So they'll wake up on the news and see themselves talking as they currently look at some point in the future, and they just sent in a FaceApp picture.
We have not had a thorough discussion on this program about deepfakes, and I hope we do in the future, because that is a threat to so many aspects of our society, especially journalism. Explain that just briefly for our listeners, Jonathan, who may not know what a deepfake is.
Okay, with artificial intelligence and machine learning, photos are able to be altered to be videos and make it like somebody is actually talking. So very recently, researchers took the Mona Lisa and made her talk, just like we saw in Forrest Gump.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at a video and one may assume this is President Obama giving this address, and that never happened. They're using technology to create a story that doesn't exist. What about facial recognition technology? Are you concerned about what FaceApp may be doing with its data in terms of creating databases of faces?
Well, when you think about it, the biometrics are on the rise, and we're going to talk, I believe, a little bit about the airport security related to biometrics as well. So if your picture can be used to both identify and authenticate you, yeah, having that in the wrong hands is a very bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Emily, how do you feel about all this?
It's interesting. A lot of the time I say, like, we're kind of in a post-privacy world. We're all public figures putting information about ourselves online. It does concern me thinking about the potential for fakes. You know, I just tweeted a picture of myself here in studio, and if someone were to modify that photo in some horrible way, of course I'd be upset about that. I saw a news story not too long ago about the Trump campaign taking stock images and using those with footage to promote something completely different than what those people ever thought their image would be used for. So there are some valid concerns there, I think.
I just want to add, though, that this pre-existed FaceApp. Mm-hmm. Because, mm-hmm. you know, if you said to me, oh, I want to get a database of names with faces, you know, LinkedIn would be one of the places I go. Mm-hmm. Flickr would be one of the places I'd go. You know, now, those sites obviously push against scraping. Scraping's the idea that you go again and again to gather things. But so it's not something we just simply say, oh, FaceApp, and that's it. So we have to think about it more comprehensively.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to just the education side of this, Emily, you mentioned before we should be teaching what terms of service mean and how to read them. Let's take it a step back. Do you feel like the way that terms of service are written are fair to users?
It's a tough question. I think they're very written in legalese that most people don't understand. But I don't know if that's
fair?
I don't know if it's likely to change. I wonder if there could be other resources where you could go and kind of see an overview of terms of service, or like a tweet length version of it, like a bot that tweeted out a summary of it or something, could be a useful tool.
Mm-hmm. Scott, what do you think about that?
I think Emily just kicked off about five app developers right there. No, in all seriousness, there's a real tension here. Now, in direct answer to your question, Facebook has attempted to make its terms of service more readable. And in preparation for today, I went back and I looked at, you know, how they address privacy, how we're going to use, or not privacy, but intellectual property rights, how they're going to use it. And they give examples. Here is what you give us. You continue to own the rights, but we may do 1, 2, 3. So Facebook has made some push to that. But there's a real tension, because go back to what we just talked about, deepfakes, AI. If I am collecting this kind of data, and I don't know, know about the future of my company. I want maximum flexibility to use it in 100 different ways. I want to make sure I can do X in Germany and in the United States, you know, and in France. So there's a real tension there. And I know people always say, oh, I want them to be really simple and really easy to read. But, you know, that's very difficult when you say to me, I want you, Scott, to draw something up that's going to protect us 10 years in the future. And we're not really sure what our business is going to be and, you know, how we're going to get financing. So there's a tension. I think the big thing for us as users is to push back and say, I'm not going to use these services. If you are not going to have good faith as Google, as Apple, as the app provider, and not look out for me, then I'm not going to participate. And, you know, if people do that, then they go away. Unilever, the advertiser, has been very active in pushing against how things have been used, how things have been posted, you know, and there are groups of advertisers who do that.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, how do you feel about terms of service? Should they be more accessible, or do you think they're written in a way that is meant to protect people and that's fair?
Oh, absolutely
not. Protect the companies.
They're not written in any way that's fair to the consumer at this point. And I'm a pretty technical guy myself, and I'm saying that. So there needs maybe to be even some dummy down form, maybe some graphical image of terms of service like we have when we put furniture together in some fashion. It definitely needs to be more understandable, more accessible, and more clear. And the data, where it's being stored, who has access to it, where it can be transferred to, that stuff needs to be mentioned.
But Megan, let me offer one example, though. So there was a Wi-Fi provider in the UK, I believe it was called Purple. And Purple ran an experiment before GDPR went out that they put that in exchange for using our Wi-Fi, you agree to give us 1,000 hours of public service in exchange for our Wi-Fi. And they listed things like cleaning toilets and doing all these just truly, truly disgusting things. 20,000 people didn't read that. So no matter how simple they are, people are not going to read them. And they indeed actually offered a prize that said, if you see these things and they're ridiculous, write us. Only one person wrote them and said, that's it. So I have to say, I appreciate where you want to make it graphical, you want to make it simpler, but the burden is on us. And I don't care how simple it is. If people don't take time to do it, then they're just going to click through.
That reminds me of something that happened. I think I was in 10th grade. Our teacher gave us a long test. And she said, I want you to read all the directions, read all the questions before you start taking the test. The paper gets down on the desks. Everybody starts writing. Because I was a goody two shoes, I read the whole thing. And at the very end of the paper, it said, do not fill out this paper. So I walked my paper up. But it's just, how often does that happen? And again, I'll out myself. I don't read the privacy statements. I don't read the terms of service. So you're making a great point, Scott. Yeah. Even if it's something ridiculous, like you have to sign up for cleaning bathrooms for 1,000 hours, you know, we live in a society where it's, again, as you mentioned before, convenience, moving quickly. So Emily, I was back when I backed up to the terms of service question, the fast forward was, what should we be teaching kids in school? So if you were invited into a classroom and they said, Emily Hesney Lynch, I want you to talk to my 7th graders about how they're submitting information online and what they need to know, what kind of presentation would you give them?
I think just a really good, simple, basic best practice is to think twice before you do anything on the internet, whether it's posting a tweet or signing or accepting the terms of service for something. Just take a step back and don't rush into it. It's so easy when everything's at the tip of your fingers to just go, 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 do the next fun thing that's an internet trend, and then you might regret it later. So it's a good place to start.
And I think some of the tools of the internet are useful to create the pushback when terms reach too far. So the vessel, you know, is a structure. It's a bunch of interconnected stairs down at Hudson Yards. And so they had terms of service that basically were very much like face apps. And they said, anybody who comes here and posts a picture or takes a picture, you sign away an insane amount of rights. And people eventually pushed back and said, this is ridiculous. You got public money. This is a public space in the middle of New York City. Or in part of New York City, and you can't put these terms of service out, and they walked them back. So I think it's a push and a pull, and the good thing is we can use social media to say, hey, here are the terms. Who else doesn't agree with them?
Mm-hmm. Listeners, we're going to take our only break of the hour, and when we come back, we'll talk about what happens when you upload your information to the cloud, because I don't understand what that means, and I would like to. And maybe some of you have questions, too. I see the phone starting to ring. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can tweet us. I'm at MMacMedia. Starting to see some feedback there. And also, you can email the program. program at connections@wxxi.org. Short break, more connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Tuesday on The Next Connections, a conversation about intellectual property rights. It was inspired by a recent tweet from a photographer who publicly called out Nike for using one of his photos without his permission and without paying him. We discuss how frequently that happens and the business culture that seems to want to use content without paying creators. We'll talk about the legal ramifications and more. You're listening to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about FaceApp, that app that shows you what you might look like when you're older with varying degrees. And we're talking about how your information is collected, shared, and stored when you submit it to social media apps like FaceApp and Facebook and many, many others. And joining me in studio, Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law, Jonathan Weissman, senior lecturer in the Department of Computing Security at RIT, and Emily Hesney Lynch, a social media strategist and founder of Serve Me the Sky Digital. I know Scott wants to talk about privacy laws. We're going to need a quick phone call before we move in that direction. I know there are a lot of questions there. But first up on the phone is Bob in Mendon. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon. I think it's important to remember that if you're not paying for a product, you are the product.
I think that is a very excellent and succinct point that we should definitely talk about. Bob, do you use social media?
I have a business, and I use it for that only. I don't use Facebook for my personal use, and I do have a LinkedIn as well. But things like Facebook and all the quizzes that the people are far too happy to take just don't appeal to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for calling. You've brought up a very important point, one that's echoed by our friend and colleague Mike Johansson on Twitter, who says, regarding today's FaceApp discussion, when will people learn nothing that is free on the web is truly free? Someone has to pay the bill somewhere, somehow, almost always with your data. So the internet is using us without us knowing most of the time. Jonathan, I'm sure you have something to say regarding that and security. I mean, how much of our information are we giving away for free? And I don't know, I'm concerned.
Well, let's start off talking about location services. Because when you're talking about location services being enabled for an app, you're talking about the fact that somebody who has access to this raw data is able to see a particular location on a map and put an identity to that particular location and follow that person, whether they're going to doctor meetings, whether they're going to psychiatric meetings, whether they're going to other people's homes. So the companies that say, look, we're stripping out the PII, we're not collecting that information, we're just looking for data patterns, we're just looking for data usage. My point is that through those patterns, very important PII can be easily gleaned.
Mm-hmm. I think the location services point is really important too, because a lot of people don't think about the concerns with that. I recently stopped using Yelp because they rolled a new feature where your locations anywhere you checked in went on a little map pinned at the top of your profile. And I would go to the gym and check in and say, great yoga class. And someone could easily look at that and say, Emily goes to yoga at this time every week. If I'm going to stalk her, I'll go here. And that's terrifying. So I deleted all my data off of there.
And it could be used the other way as well. They could find some anonymous dot on the map and then trace that person and then put an identity based on where they go or maybe where they're working as well.
There was a New York Times story, I think it was last year, we talked about it on the show, where a woman found out that location services was tracking her. They caught up with her at her therapist, her ex-boyfriend's house, her work. They tracked how many hours she spent at each place. It was this big story. I'll see if I can find it during the hour. But how often is that happening?
I read that article, and I remember that article very well. Very famous article that was sort of like the shocking moment when location services were hitting the world. And you think about it, there are thousands of times a day. Some apps actually do it every couple of seconds where they track where you are. Of course, it eats up battery usage, but you're constantly being monitored almost 24/7, 365 with the location services. And in that New York Times article, I believe there was only one person in the entire world who followed a pattern from coordinate 1 to coordinate 2, and they could uniquely identify that one person because she was the only one who, I believe it was that teacher, she was the only one who went from her house house at this location to her office at that location. They tracked children. In that particular New York Times article, they talked about how jails were being monitored with location services as well, people visiting jails, people visiting police offices. They talked about how you could uniquely identify certain people without even knowing their PII to begin with.
Now, you know, and I just want to say that there are folks who are looking at this, and, you know, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, state attorneys generals are doing investigations to say what were the promises. Again, this goes back to the terms of service. It goes back to the representations about what the business is. So people shouldn't say, oh, this is completely a Wild West, but they're definitely something to be concerned with. I think if you want to personalize this for you, look at your phone and say, look, you know, look at the terms of service and say, or the tools and say, how do I download my location? Like, Google will give you an update every month. Here's where you've been. And that can personalize this so you can really get an idea of how much you're being tracked.
I'm wondering, how much do we have to sacrifice in order to push for advancements in technology? And this is something, you know, it's related to conversations about AI and automation. I mean, where is the balance? I'll ask each of you, how much should we be willing to sacrifice in terms of privacy in order to advance technology to create a society in which we're continually moving forward, Jonathan?
Well, I always talk about this in all my classes. It's the epic seesaw. It's the convenience versus security seesaw. When one side goes down, the other side goes up. And there is no happy medium, and there's no right or wrong. It has to be done on an individual basis. It's got to be done on a case-by-case basis. And sometimes you have to make mistakes in order to get it a little bit right.
Mm-hmm. Emily?
I think a lot of the time when I am thinking about this, I don't mind if I'm being used to create an advertising profile. If it's millennial woman who likes to do yoga and read books, you know, that's fine. Go ahead and market to me based on whatever you think that means about me. But I do worry about the larger things, you know, a data breach where I would lose my social security number or passwords or anything like that. And it's hard to say how you can control any of that and what our role is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Scott?
You know, I want to address a related factor, and that's the idea that the privacy expectation window continues to move. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you the example. So when EasyPass first came out, you know, especially in the law, it was, oh my gosh, divorce lawyers are going to, you know, subpoena this stuff, and they're going to find out that you were going to see your, you know, your mistress or your mister, okay? And now, you know, the governor has proposed no toll takers anywhere on the thruway, anywhere on the bridges that take tolls, which is necessitates, you know, having image recognition for your license plates because some folks don't have EasyPass. So that window has now moved from, oh my gosh, you got off at exit 45 to here's an image of your vehicle, mm-hmm. who was in it, et cetera, et cetera. So that is a big concern. The image keeps, the window keeps moving. And I go back to Emily's Spotify example. You know, when I see those things, I am horrified. And I'm just like, what the heck, especially if I'm paying for the service. I don't care mm-hmm. that you anonymized it. You know, if I'm playing Born to Run 157 times in a row, that's not fair for you to do that. Not that I've ever done that.
no judgment. No judgment zone.
I feel like it. You did.
Can we get out of the show with this instead of the theme?
She's judging me with her eyes.
As far as the EasyPass example, you might remember that when it first came out, people were getting tickets because they were traveling too fast towards a certain exit. So I actually know some people that were driving on some highway, and they did the math, and they figured out they were going to get a ticket because they were driving so fast. They actually pulled over to the side and waited a few minutes so that the ticket wouldn't be automatically generated based on when they entered versus when they exited the highway.
Huh. Yeah, and that's a great example of our behavior when why not just drive the speed limit mm-hmm. if that was your concern?
Exactly.
So maybe the question, and this ties back into what you said, Emily, maybe we shouldn't be using these apps at all. And right. I say that because Derek Thompson, writing for The Atlantic, wrote that climate change is a metaphor for privacy. And he wrote, it's especially fitting here, meaning the technology side. If enough people individually choose plastic and gas-guzzling cars, we will all be left with warming seas and noxious air. If enough people individually decide that a goofy selfie is worth the risk to their own privacy, we're all at risk of invasive targeting and omni-surveillance and so on. Should we stop using all social media apps? Easier said than done. But
it doesn't
have
to be.
Do you agree with that metaphor?
In a way, but it doesn't have to be black and white, cut and dry. Mm-hmm. Like we've been saying, everything should be evaluated on a, does that really make sense? Does it really need that permission type of basis?
I also think it goes deeper, you know, to the idea of that selfie culture. Let's go to Instagram, and you hear places that are very frustrated with now there are 50,000 tourists and they all want to take this selfie, and it's undermining the value of the place. And I think that's something we should be very conscientious of on an individual level. Why am I doing this? Why am I taking this? And I think this helps in the app environment too. In preparation for this show, I went through a few apps and I was like, oh, I can delete that, you know, as opposed to when you're flying and you're terrified the plane is not going to get you where you want to go. You're like, I'm going to download the JetBlue app and I'm going to have it because I don't want to be the 58th person in line trying to get that flight changed.
Right. Mm-hmm. We got a couple phone calls coming in. Up first on the phones is Jane in Rochester. Hi, Jane.
Oh, hi, Megan. I don't want people to laugh at this, but I never did forget what happened to Anthony Weiner. And I really felt empathy because I thought, how many of us have done things that we would not want the world to see? They're not illegal. Nobody died. He had a few drinks, and he did something that for the world to see, it would be undignified, and that's the worst you could say. And yet it so embarrassed him, apparently, he left office. And so I feel like that sort of thing can be so misused and taken out of context. And I just ask you, I mean, have you ever done anything stupid that you still would not want the whole world to see? And so things can be twisted around and misused, and people can lose office. And I think that's a very negative thing that can happen. And it seemed to me to be a private behavior. But anyway, if someone would comment on that, please.
Sure. Jane, let me just ask you a follow-up question.
Okay.
So taking Anthony Weiner as an example, he posted those images and he was, you know, the reaction came accordingly. You're saying that reaction was unfair because those were private pictures that he mistakenly posted online?
Just personally, I felt like it was a loss because he was such an effective orator. You know, he knew how to speak to constituents and so forth, and I found him very powerful. And I feel like we need that sort of voice. That's just personal, but it just seemed. Why would you do this to a person unless he was in your way or saying things you don't like, and they in effect overturned an election? So, ask me that question again. I don't know quite what you mean. Ask me that again, Megan, please.
I guess the question is more about personal responsibility. So he made what could be considered a mistake. Is it fair? Was the reaction fair? And it seems like you don't think in this case it was.
I just think that it was a loss.
Mm-hmm.
A loss. And yes, he made choices, and I think he'd been drinking. And again, though, I say, is there no one who hasn't been overly playful or, you know, doing something that maybe shouldn't have been doing, but yet it wasn't a serious a moral lapse. It was a judgment lapse, maybe. But I don't know what the solution to that is other than just to say the opposition research and maliciousness is certainly in play in a lot of instances where you take things out of context. That was probably a rare behavior for him. But anyway, I just felt like it was our loss. But you can so embarrass someone that they actually can't continue in office. And I wonder at times about the male gender, that they take such chances. We, you know, we had Elliot Spitzer. We have all kinds of men who did things and did them over the cell phone, you know, made appointments and so forth that we would think would know better, you know, than to do that, to risk so much on so little and to do that on the cell phone. So, yeah, they have some responsibility in their judgment. I agree with that very much. But I still say it's a loss at times. Thank you very much, Megan.
Thank you, Jane. Well, let's turn it over to our guest, Scott.
You know, Megan, I think that example is a really good summary of two of the big problems for digital tools and devices. One is record, right? Before we had these devices, there was no record. If you were going to take a photo before cell phones, you had to get it developed. It was expensive. It was slow. You know, by the time it came out, except for a news organization, it's like, well, that's not news anymore. We're not going to do it. Now you instantaneously can create the record. You can share it. The other problem is social media is stunningly decontextualizing. You know, somebody can take a 10-second Nancy Pelosi, Nick Sandman, both good examples of taking a portion of a story, putting it out there with your own spin on it. And I think those are the two big problems that create these constant situations of, oh, I'm outraged, I'm upset, you know. And so that's what we have to be very cognizant of as individuals and as a society, and pushing back and saying, all right, wait a minute, let's give ourselves more time, get more of a story, get more context. And again, using the tools appropriately.
Emily, thoughts on what Jane mentioned in terms of personal responsibility was reaction unfair? I know she's talking about a very specific case, but on the whole, in a society that's quick to judge and share and images and such.
Yeah, we all make mistakes, but the internet is forever. People think the internet is ephemeral. It's really not. There are screenshots, there are archives, there are always ways to turn up things that you've posted or said or done that you think are just going to go away, and they're really not. So you always have to think twice, be proud of what you're doing, whether it's sending a text, sending a tweet, anything like that.
And I just want to add real quick, not to cut Emily off, but privacy settings are kind of a myth, in the sense of, I will hear this all the time in litigation. People are like, oh, but if that's set to private. And I said, that's great. It's still discoverable in litigation. Or somebody who was in the meeting may have taken the picture or recorded the conversation, and just because you put it behind a privacy wall doesn't mean it's not going to come out. So you can't really rely on that. You got to go back to exactly what Emily said.
So what should our expectations be in terms of privacy, Jonathan?
Well, I like to think about the following analogy. If you're on a cliff, beautiful background, would you be willing to risk your life on that cliff, on the edge, to take a selfie? Most people wouldn't, but unfortunately we've been hearing such terrible stories come out of the news where people fell off the cliff and died while taking very risky selfies. I like to think of it the same way in the digital sense. Would you be willing for your pictures or any information you transmit to be in the hands of the wrong people, to be misused, to be leaked? And you've got to basically think of yourself as on the edge of the cliff and wonder, if I upload this, if I use this, if I transmit this information, can it come back to haunt me and bite me?
259 people died between 2011 and 2017 taking dangerous selfies. 259 people.
Is and you know what? The Facebook app could eventually turn out to be such a dangerous selfie at some point in the future. Maybe not as physically dangerous, but dangerous as far as the human life goes.
The face app.
We should remember, though, this is a dynamic environment, in the sense of, that's part of the challenge. Things change so often in terms of service change. You know, as Emily said, I was using app and all of a sudden it's tagging me and now I'm unhappy. One example of a change it may be for the better is Instagram is testing not showing how many likes there are of a photo. And so, you know, they're testing in a number of countries around the world. Hopefully that will discourage people from saying, well, taking this dangerous selfie is going to get me 10 times as many likes. Mm-hmm. They'll know it was liked, but they won't know the level of it. And so hopefully it will take away some of the competition.
Okay. So what should our, I'll ask you the same question I asked Jonathan, what should our expectations be in terms of privacy from a legal standpoint?
You know, it's really a challenge. I think what we are going to do is we're going to see America move more towards what Europe has with GDPR. It's one of the few areas where we're seeing politicians on both sides of the aisle agreeing and saying we've got to change this. Additionally, we're seeing states looking at this. California has passed its own version of privacy that is to go into effect in 2020. It's not clear exactly what the parameters will be. New York State, other states have pushed even farther in enacting their own. New York, the bill did not pass, but there was an element that said there would be a $10,000 fine that individuals could sue for violations of that particular Privacy Act. And so when, you know, if Emily puts up 10 photos a day and it's $100,000, that gets people's notice pretty quickly. Are you smiling because you put up more than 10 photos a day?
I don't think I put up more than 10 a day, no.
I'm just picking on you.
Again, no judgment zone. Everybody's on edge today. No, but that did not pass, you said.
It did not pass. No, it didn't go forward. And there's a lot of tension, because if we have 50 states and we have the District of Columbia, it could be very hard for anybody who's a professional, you know, like Emily probably has clients across the country, and saying, how do I manage what Connecticut expects, what New York expects, what California expects? So it can be very difficult. That's why a federal statute, a federal guidance may be better.
Some of your feedback coming in on Twitter. This is Andy. He says, I have not used FaceApp as I try not to fall subject to the challenge of the week. Also, with face recognition technology becoming more of a thing to unlock devices, I don't need a company having my dimensions. The Russian connection only enhanced my wariness. there are some other comments that are very similar to that. And that leads to, I know, Scott, you and I talked offline about the airport. Mm-hmm. Facial recognition technology coming to the Rochester International Airport as part of the renovations. I know you have some thoughts on that. We did reach out to the county. I did not hear back. We'll hope to have a future conversation with them on that. But I will say that Airport Director Andy Moore said that let me just read from the Democrat and Chronicle, concealed surveillance systems will soon scan and analyze the face of every person who enters the airport. Their system will compare airport visitors' images only to databases supplied by anti-terrorism or law enforcement agencies. So while your face will be scanned when you walk through the terminal's front door, county officials vow the system won't know who you are and will keep no long-term record of your presence. There's been some pushback on this, especially from organizations like the ACLU, saying that certain people are more likely to be, you know, mistaken based on the dimensions of their face or other characteristics, and that's unfair. Scott, I know you have a lot to say on this issue.
Yeah. And let's bring up unfair analysis. There have been, you know, a number of studies that have said facial recognition is not as accurate as we would hope, and it's not accurate for African Americans, it's not accurate for women as it is for men, as for people who are Caucasian. And so that is, you know, the first thing. If there is a false positive, you have a high rate of false positives or false negatives, especially for certain subgroups, how are you going to respond? And secondly, do we get 2 years down the road and people are just looking at the technology and saying, well, I got a hit and we got to do something, instead of saying the technology may be flawed and having disparate results? So that's one we got to be concerned with. The other thing is we have to be concerned with, I appreciate that they've said we're only going to keep it, you know, but that's one of those things that you constantly want to follow up with. As I mentioned about Alexa, we don't keep it as long as you delete it. And then you find out, well, we're kind of keeping some stuff. And I would be very concerned with, are you going to have a record that I went to the airport five mm-hmm. times, I have to travel for work, et cetera, over the last 5 years? Or are you just keeping it for 24 hours to check against, say, a database of people who shouldn't be flying? So, I mean, the devil is in the details. But the difference between apps and these situations are it's not voluntary.
Right.
You know, and we see, I think it was the Niagara Falls School District mm-hmm. was implementing these tools. And, you know, now students have to go to school. Why are you making parents and students make that choice, not making it voluntary?
I think concerns about this issue in San Francisco, in that city, they barred the use of technology by city agencies.
Correct.
Emily, do you have concerns? If you went to the airport, would you mind that your face is being scanned? Does that bother you?
It's something I haven't given that much thought to yet because it still feels far away, even though it's certainly not. I'd like to think that they're not going to use it for anything nefarious, but, you know.
The county is not here, so I will repeat, they vow that they won't. Jonathan, what do you think?
It's not a matter of what they're going to do with it. It's a matter of who has access to that particular database. And we've seen with all the breaches of past couple of years, something can be hacked. If something can be hacked, it will be. So at some point in time, I expect to hear of some unfortunate breach. In fact, there was a breach about a couple years ago related to some airport-related information. I believe it was pictures that were stolen.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, Scott?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think it was the pictures that were stolen. So
I always feel kind of a certain sense of inevitability about all of this. Like, sure, that facial recognition stuff is going to happen. Sure, there's going to be a data breach, but what am I really supposed to do about it? I don't know if either of you, Scott or Jonathan, have thoughts about that.
Again, it goes to convenience versus security. And I prefer security over convenience. I'd rather wait a little bit longer on a line or on multiple lines than to have my information just out there.
And I think that's right. It's up to us to bend the curve and to say, how is this being used? If you are saying we're using this in a very tight manner and it's only for screening purposes and it's against a very defined database, I think most people would say, yeah, that's efficient. I get that. I understand that. Versus a very different set of uses where we keep the data. And not to be unfair to the county, you're seeing private entities who want to use this. Mm-hmm. Oh, you go to the mall and now it's recognizing that Megan's there and Megan likes to shop at these particular stores.
We've got sports stadiums as well nowadays.
Right. I think it was Taylor Swift was using this at a concert.
Yes.
You know, and again, not fair because you're in this really, if you're a parent, my child wants to go to this concert and all of a sudden now I'm being asked to do this stuff with their images.
As Scott's daughter is sitting right next to him, so it's close to home. We're down to our last minute or so of the program, and I just want to ask each of our guests as we close things out, what direction are we headed in? Are we moving in a direction of consumers, users taking back some of that ownership of privacy, not using apps to some certain extent, or pushing back on terms of service so that we're not making some of the sacrifices that we're making now? Or do you think we're going to continue to move in the direction of, well, it's convenient, it's easy, it's fun, I'm going to do it? Emily.
I think I'd like to think it's a little bit of both. I think some people are becoming more aware, but it takes a while for that awareness to rise and for people to start paying attention, really. So,
okay, Jonathan?
I think people are becoming more aware, just not enough and not quick enough.
Okay, Scott?
I think we're going to have to look at the statutes that come out of Congress and the state legislators.
Well, we will continue to do that, continue to have these types of conversations, because technology continues to evolve. I want to thank all my guests today, Scott Maloof, Jonathan Weissman, Emily Hesney Lynch. Thank you all for being here, sharing your insight.
Thanks,
and
Megan.
Not your face app photos.
Thanks, Megan.
Maybe next
thank
time.
You.
Thanks to our engineer, always doing excellent work every day, Rob Braden. Gary Putup helping us out on phones today. Bob, our volunteer every Monday. Our thanks to him. I'm Megan Mack. Evan Dawson will be back with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to member-supported public radio.